Frank and Fran. Every party has a pooper. Frank, Father of the Bride, Part 2, 1995. There's Eccentric, and then there's Martin Short as Frank Egelhofer in the 90s classics Father of the Bride and Father of the Bride, Part 2. The performance, in my opinion, is one of the all-time greatest, an overlooked comedic role for the ages. Every year, when award nominations come out, I get upset about the iconic roles that get snubbed, sometimes because the movies themselves aren't great, and other times because the actors don't subscribe to the politics of award season. Either way, Martin Short's on-screen presence will be remembered long after most of the dramatic recipients receive their gold statues. And so will Regina Hall's performance in the Scary Movie franchise, Jennifer Elise Cox and Christine Taylor in the Brady Bunch movies, Anna Faris in everything, Lisa Kudrow and Mira Sorvino in Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, Joan Cusack in Adam's Family Values, and so on. These roles may not be the most awarded, but they will all live on in memes and GIFs for an eternity, with gay men on the internet ensuring that they are never forgotten. Frank is a personal favorite of mine for many reasons, first and foremost because those movies are comfort food in film form. Watching the Nancy Meyers, Charles Shire flicks feels like wrapping yourself in a blanket of love on a cozy evening. When my anxiety is high, I simply need to turn on the Steve Martin movie for an instant boost of endorphins. When I was growing up, there wasn't a lot of gay representation in media. One of the reasons I think it took me so long to come out is because I didn't see many examples of people living healthy and successful lives as out homosexuals within scripted media. When there were gay characters in film and TV, they often felt like stereotypes or the butt of the joke. I did sketch comedy at a very popular theater in Los Angeles during my 20s, and I wrote a scene with a straight male. The two of us were playing co-workers at a company holiday party, and we couldn't figure out a way to wrap up the scene. Someone suggested that the two characters kiss at the end of the sketch, not because they were in love, but because it felt like the easiest way to go out on a laugh. I didn't want to do it, but I never spoke up, and we eventually performed the lip lock in front of a huge audience. The moment the straight actor kissed me on the lips, the crowd erupted in laughter. The sexuality became the punchline, and this was in the 2010s. They laughed because audiences have been trained to equate straight men kissing other men with comedy, whether it be on SNL when John Krasinski kissed Pete Davidson during his 2021 monologue, or back in the 90s when the movie In-N-Out had Kevin Kline and Tom Selleck smooch for giggles. It's exhausting. The Frank character is never officially revealed to be gay in Father of the Bride, which raises a different set of issues. Characters were frequently coded as gay because studios worried that making them outright homosexuals would be too much for viewers to handle, and many times these characterizations were written by straight people. Our community had to settle for scraps. Frank had no romantic subplot, and although his assistant, played by B.D. Wong, feels like a boyfriend or partner to the audience, it's never stated as such. Even so, I still read the character as homosexual, and in the film, all the qualities that I would normally cringe at in a gay character from the era, I loved. The nuance that Martin brought transcended all the stereotyped flamboyance and gave us the most memorable role in that movie. He was messy, dramatic, had an indistinguishable accent and favorite extravagance, but it was impossible to walk away from that film not adoring Frank. Let's take a little detour. There's another F-R-A-N who has had a big impact on me. Of course, I'm talking about Fran Drescher. The nanny is everything to me. Style guide, life guru, and a fictional character who can single-handedly save me from my own neuroses. Fran has also always been a wonderful LGBTQ+ ally. Aside from being a flawless role for Miss Drescher, the theme song is the greatest television theme song of all time. I'm sorry, I don't make the rules. My appendix burst recently, and moments after arriving at the ER, a doctor told me I would need surgery to have it removed. I don't love surgery, to put it lightly. As someone who's already anxious enough, the idea of cutting me open to remove an organ is not great. Luckily, they have drugs for people like me. Before they brought me in for the anesthesia, they loaded me with morphine and some other concoction that can only be described as heavenly. Just as the meds were kicking in, my nurses were switching shifts. As high as I was still scared about going into the operating room all alone. Fortunately, I didn't have to go in solo, as one of the employees clocking in was a young woman named Fran, who swooped in and held my hand tight as I waited impatiently. "Hi, I'm Fran. I'll be your nurse for the rest of the night," she said. "Fran! I love Fran!" I replied to a woman I'd never met. "Do you watch The Nanny?" "I've seen it before." Fran, the nurse, wheeled me into the operating room, where she continued to hold my hand as I met the anesthesiologist. Everything from that point on is a blur, but when I came to after they removed my appendix, Fran told me I was an A-plus patient. "Normally, when we give patients anesthesia, we have them count down from 10 until they pass out. You didn't do any counting, but you did get halfway through The Nanny theme song, the part about style and flair." "She was there!" I shouted, still high as a kite. I'm forever grateful to Fran, the nurse, and all the nurses who work so tirelessly to make patients feel comfortable during those terrifying moments when we're sick and fragile inside the hospital walls. Furthermore, I'm grateful to Fran Drescher for creating a character who's so comforting in times of need. In a full circle moment, I got a chance to tell Fran about my hospital story when she came on my show. Her warmth and humor heals. All this is to say I love Martin Short's character and his energy. About twice a year, I rewatch the flicks and fall in love all over again. Last time I did, I walked around for about a week after shouting, "Hello!" in the cadence of my fave wedding planner, or "Mother and daughter are pregnant together? Get out of town!" I'd do the impression for anyone who would listen, and turns out not everyone is amused by my character work. I'm not sure if any of you have ever had pre-workout drink, a devil's powder that I can only assume is filled with a mix of caffeine, pixie sticks, and crack cocaine, designed to give consumers the energy to lift a car when they arrive at their local Planet Fitness. For months, I'd been taking a couple scoops of pre-workout before going to a group fitness class held in a dark room where they played Dua Lipa remixes for an hour. I noticed the drink was not good for someone like me who suffers from anxiety, but I still wanted something to give me a jolt before the class. Enter pre-workout gummies. Nowadays, they make everything in gummy form: vitamins, melatonin, weed. The gym I went to offered me a pack of these specific gummies for $6.99, but one day they had someone giving away free samples, so I threw them in my bag and saved them for when I needed them. One Saturday morning, I had signed up for my class, which was non-refundable, and had a little mini hangover from some bed wine the night before, but otherwise was in a great mood. I wish I could say that I spent Friday getting wild with some friends, but the truth is, I put a face mask on for self-care, hashtag face mask Friday, opened the bed wine while the mask dried, and then accidentally fell asleep with the mask still on. Tale as old as time. Regardless, my mini hangover was enough to dissuade me from going to the class I signed up for, and coffee wasn't doing it, so I grabbed my pre-workout energy gummies and shoved the entire pack in my mouth. I should have read the packaging. Turns out you're supposed to take 1 to 2 gummies 30 to 60 minutes before the workout. I got the timing right, but I took the entire package, which was 10 to 12 actual gummies. Woo! I was a lot. The energy hit me hard and almost immediately. My drive to the gym was intense as I sang the Pussycat Dolls' greatest hits and some 90s rap at the tippy top of my lungs. My BPM was about 574, and I began sweating more than I ever have at an actual workout. Furthermore, I'm already a terrible driver, but a mouthful of energy gummies turned me into a dangerous presence on the road. The good news is that I was alert. The bad news is that my hands were shaking, and I wanted to drive as fast as humanly possible. I was also running late, so I was texting my friend to let him know and to reserve my spot. Never text and drive. It's so incredibly dangerous, and I'm lucky nothing happened other than I eventually ran a red light. It's no excuse, but I had no control over anything by this point due to the devil's candy. Hindsight is 20/20. A cop saw me and turned on his lights, signaling for me to pull over. I was scared, still shaking. "You had your cell phone out," the officer said right when I rolled down my window. "I'm sorry, I..." "And your head was bouncing everywhere," he added. "I know, I'm sorry, I was doing some bad rapping. I'm embarrassed." He tilted his head, raised his brows out of the top of his aviator sunglasses, and looked me right in my twitching eyes. "I haven't done any bad rapping since Christmas," he said, just missing a ba-dum-tsh sound effect. I took this to believe that he and I now had a rapport. He made a little gif-rap joke, and although he didn't smile after he said it, it was definitely a joke, right? It was enough for me to exhale for the first time since I saw his lights going off. "Can I see your license and registration?" he asked. I handed the man my license and searched my glove compartment for my registration. There were papers everywhere, a stack of things I shoved inside. My car is a hot mess, so he stood there, waiting for me to find the forms. After what felt like 45 minutes, I finally found my registration, and because I thought we had a comedic relationship, I let out a very loud and aggressive, "Hello!" a la Frank Egelhofer. He gave me a familiar look, one that said, "What the F are you doing?" "That's my Frank," I explained. "Who?" "From Father of the Bride, Frank." No response. He simply walked away and wrote up my ticket. Maybe I should have written him a ticket for not knowing Father of the Bride. I never made it to the workout class, instead deciding I already missed too much of it and my time would be better spent going home to watch a movie. As I looked at my collection, I noticed there were more options of flicks with LGBTQ+ characters than there were back when I first watched Martin Short as Mr. Egelhofer, characters who were allowed to be outright homosexuals and sometimes even the star of their own stories. Still, I wonder when there will be a big-budget action movie with a gay lead or an animated feature with lesbians who have more than one line of dialogue. I feel for all the minorities who have yet to see themselves as the heroes and villains and wedding planners and stylish nannies on screen. I'll continue to plead and fight for more robust representation, and in the meantime, I'll celebrate the Francs and Frans we've loved along the way. The shawl. Is this chicken what I have, or is this fish? I know it's tuna, but it says chicken by the sea. Jessica Simpson. I would like to take a moment to talk a little bit about a story that's irresistible. Jessica Simpson released a memoir called Open Book. When the paperback came out, she included real entries from her journal. Before we go any further, I'd like to do the same. Dear Diary, Dolly Parton, Tom Hanks, there are but a handful of universally liked celebrities, the kind of people who the mere mention of will elicit a smile, a fond memory. Through extensive pop culture research, I've found that Queen Jessica Simpson is one of those people. Her case is interesting because her biggest professional success is her clothing line, which isn't as flashy or in-your-face as music or acting is. Jess has done both of those other things, and done them well, I might add, but her true appeal is her relatability. I first fell in love with her during the early pop years. She entered the music scene with a grocery store anthem called "I Wanna Love You Forever." To this day, it's rare to be in the frozen pizza section picking up a DiGiorno without hearing her belt about cherishing every drop on her knees, a troubling lyric to say the least. I think many gay men, or rather closeted young boys of that era, became obsessed with the invisible pop princess wars that plagued TRL. Come to think of it, I think it was the media once again pitting women against each other. The truth is, they were all amazing. Britney was always number one as she arrived on the scene first and garnered the most attention. Many people discount Britney as a vocalist, but I always thought she was incredibly talented in that department. Specifically, there's a quality about Britney's phrasing that is unparalleled, but that's a tale for another time. Christina was number two, never quite reaching the heights of Brit, but an enormous talent with stunning pipes. I'll never forget the VH1 Behind the Music where Christina's version of Reflection is discussed and her ability to hit a high E above middle C. Every other singer was shook. The third slot was a tug of war between Jess and Mandy Moore. Mandy seemed to inch ahead during the Walk to Remember era, but I think Jessica was winning during that time she did a song with her then-boyfriend Nick for the Here on Earth soundtrack. P.S. Remember Lily Sobieski? SOS on Lily. Although Jessica Irresistible Simpson and Mandy I Wanna Be With You More were neck and neck, they were always just a beat behind Xtina Dirty Aguilera and Britney I'm Not a Girl, Not Yet a Woman Spears. That is, until Newlyweds, which changed the course of history forever. The year was 2003. iTunes had just launched. The Lizzie McGuire movie took the box office by storm. By storm, I mean I personally saw it in theaters more than once. Mike Myers had made us all feel like we were on acid with his live-action Cat in the Hat film, and the whale from Free Willy passed. It's also the year MTV debuted one of their most popular shows of all time, starring Jessica and her new husband, Nick, whom she had married in October of 2002. Jess and Nick seemed like a match made in heaven, and combining their star power catapulted them to the top spot in the early aughts. When that first episode of Newlyweds aired, audiences were hungry for celeb reality. The Osbournes had become a huge hit, but there weren't many other shows that showcased celebrities in the same way. People who loved Ozzy and Sharon could now get their fix from a newly married couple, and years before social media would give fans access to the personal lives of the rich and famous, MTV was there. That first episode is shocking upon rewatch. Nowadays, reality shows have more of a narrative structure, and the production value is similar to that of scripted fare. If you put on The Real Housewives on Bravo, you'll notice the cast members are always mic'd, with full hair and makeup in most of their scenes. Back then, it was more casual, with multiple scenes of Jess and Nick at chain restaurants. Newlyweds catapulted them onto the A-list. Suddenly, they were everywhere, but Jess seemed to get the bigger professional boost. Her music career, which at the time was fledgling a bit, was now bigger than ever. They re-released one of her albums, With You became a radio smash, and she started moving lots of merch, my favorite being the lickable dessert beauty line. There's an infamous episode of Newlyweds where Jessica gets a stomach ache filming the promo for the line and struggles to finish the shoot. Ah, memories. By the end of Newlyweds, you could tell the two did not care for each other. The final episode was about the couple moving into a bigger house and reflecting on their time. They never actually moved into another house together, and their reflecting was a way to wrap the series as quickly as possible while filming as little as possible with each other. They went their separate ways, and I had to learn to accept it. Nick finally had a hit in What's Left of Me, which was about the dissolution of his relationship, and it's also a video that features his now wife. Jessica didn't have a huge post-breakup song like he did, hashtag justice for I Belong to Me, but she did have something even better ahead of her, a billion-dollar fashion empire. During the Newlyweds era, Jessica's sister Ashley also rose to fame on her own MTV show. Destined to be a star, her first single catapulted her onto the A-list alongside Jess. It's rumored, by me only, that the Hemsworth brothers modeled their career after the success of the Simpson siblings. The two sisters even sang a duet of The Little Drummer Boy at an ABC variety hour that I will never, ever forget. We're going to have to stop there. The publisher tells me this audiobook is supposed to be focused on my life and also that they didn't pay me to write an oral history of the Simpson family. Please note, I'm open to doing one of those if the money is right and even maybe if it isn't. Okay, back to me. The MTV Newlyweds era was truly fabulous, not just because of the storylines or performances, but because of the fashions. I'm not a fashionista. Every time I leave the house, I worry a morning show will ambush makeover me, but I do know about the massive style influence Jessica had in the aughties. There was, of course, her multicolored Louis Vuitton bag, the Ken Paves hairstyling, and my personal favorite, the legendary yellow shawl. The shawl was worn throughout the entire series, and Jess also had an alternate version that she wore on tour in the early aughts. It was so beloved, I dedicated an Instagram post to the piece, with hundreds of people commenting about how much they loved it too. I even remember when it aired, so many of the girls in my high school tried to pull off a similar look, but most of them just looked like they draped their grandma's afghans over their teenage shoulders. Thousands of likes later, Cecilia D. Bucourt, the designer of the shawl, reached out to me via DM to thank me for spotlighting her creation. I was honored that she was messaging me, and she could not have been nicer. She asked if I would want her to send me one, telling me they are all handmade, so each one looks a little bit different, but she would get it to look as close to Jessica's as she could. As much as I love to get free stuff, I live in a small apartment and don't have a ton of space for extras, but I could not say no to this opportunity. I sent the designer my P.O. Box address, and a few days later, it arrived. My P.O. Box doesn't have ample parking for patrons, but I was able to find a spot on a busy West Hollywood street. I went in to get my mail and was so excited to see the package with the designer listed on the return address. I ripped it open and marveled at my new ladies' statement piece, which looked almost exactly like the one on Newlyweds. As I walked back to my car, I was on such a high that I decided to treat myself to a donut from a nearby shop. I gently tossed the shawl into the front seat along with my other mail and headed to pick up a half dozen of the most delicious blueberry and glazed in Los Angeles. That's Tasty Donuts on Santa Monica. Nothing better than a donut, especially when they're fresh, perfectly crispy on the outside and pillowy on the inside with a sweet sugar glaze. After I picked up the snack, I once again headed back to my car. From afar, I noticed a man at my passenger door with a crowbar that he was using to seemingly break into my vehicle. I wish I could tell you that I was concerned he was stealing my mail or planning to hotwire my car, but the truth is the only thing that came to mind was that my Newlyweds shawl was resting in the front seat. Who knows if I would be able to get another that looked as good as the one I got in the mail that day? Maybe I could have paid for another, but I didn't have tons of money to be spending on women's clothing that was popular in 2004. "Hey, get away from my Jessica Simpson shawl!" I shouted as I ran toward the man breaking into my car. I've never been a fighter. I mean, I'm not much of a lover either, but I certainly don't want to come in contact with anyone dangerous. And yet there I was, running to someone brave enough to break into a stranger's car in the middle of the day. Not only that, but as I got closer, I noticed that he was a very strong-looking man, albeit on the shorter side, which I tend to like. He had white hair and a beard, with huge biceps bursting out of his red t-shirt. Looking like a hot miniature Santa that could kick my ass would normally turn me on more than I can express in words, but I was pissed and preparing myself to fight little old Saint Nick. "That's my car," I continued, "and my Newlyweds shawl." The man looked up and noticed me running toward him. Well, I'm not sure I was running as much as I was shuffling and trying not to lose any of my fresh donuts. Unfortunately, it was all for naught, as the flimsy box holding my fried dough decided to give out on my way to save my mustard shoulder draping. We honestly need donut box reform because they jam them inside a box that looks like it's stapled together with construction paper. A gust of wind would tear that thing apart, so there was no safe way to run with a box like that. The donuts fell to the ground one by one as I got closer to my Honda, and I was devastated. I stopped briefly to consider picking them off the dirty road, but ultimately decided not to when I remembered that one time I saw a used condom on the ground outside my P.O. box. "Get away from my Newlyweds shawl! It's one of a kind!" I screamed louder, this time even more intimidating, weaponizing the devastation of losing my donuts to the sex-stained concrete. Santa wiggled his crowbar out of my window and ran like hell away from me like I was a child catching him eating my cookies on Christmas Eve night. Knowing the shawl was safe, I slowed down to catch my breath. I eventually made my way to the car and was relieved to see my yellow statement piece safely in the passenger seat where I had left it. When I got home, I recounted the events to my boyfriend, explaining that this man was trying to steal my famous shawl. "He was probably trying to steal your car," my boyfriend said. "No, he was at the passenger window, not the driver's side," I assured him. "Did you have any other mail?" he asked. "Well, yeah, just a few letters that I picked up with the gift. Oh, and my phone was in the car with it because I accidentally left it in there." "So he was trying to steal your phone," my boyfriend said. "You don't get it. You obviously just don't get it. It's the yellow shawl from Newlyweds. That's what he wanted," I explained. If he was breaking in during the middle of the day, risking getting caught by someone, anyone, in the neighborhood, I assure you that he wasn't trying to get your sweater, he said. "It's a shawl from MTV, and I wish I didn't catch him, because I bet next Christmas you would have seen him wearing it when he delivered presents to our house," I playfully, albeit also angrily, added. My boyfriend rolled his eyes at me while I went to the other room to watch TV. As I sat down to watch the view, a breeze came in from the open door of our living room. Luckily, I had my newlywed shawl to keep me warm. Sun will rise. I wanted to die just a handful of years ago. Saying that makes my hands shake and my heart race. The idea is so disparate from the smiley Midwest persona I give off, and I'm scared to even tell you more because somehow discussing it makes it feel even more real. Will you see me differently now? Will the rest of my words hold less weight in comparison? Only now, in hindsight, can I see that my mental health struggles are part of my story, but not my entire story. By now, you might be wondering about my dark side. Everyone has one. Kelly Clarkson even released a song called Dark Side that wasn't quite the hit it should have been, hashtag justice for Dark Side, but it was proof that even Queen Kelly has some demons. My dark side comes in the form of depression and anxiety that rear their ugly heads quite often. As a lover of reality television, I typically enjoy the type of shade that comes from the mouth of a real housewife, but there's another kind of shade in my life that's more difficult to endure. There's a pitch-black cloud that drifts over me and covers all the light every once in a while that I'd be remiss not to talk about with all of you. Never was that cloud darker than a fateful drive to the happiest place on earth. When most people talk about mental health, it's often through language like light and dark and sun and clouds. By now, we should have a better way of describing the inner turmoil one goes through in life, but we don't, or specifically, I don't. I find the easiest and best way is through the type of words that you would find in the journal of an emo mid-aughts teen who wore Nightmare Before Christmas clothes year-round, so bear with me here. I'm a generally happy person, but there are times in my life when the anxiety and depression seep into my everyday existence and crush me, most recently just a few weeks ago, but it's been happening on and off for years with one particularly no good, very bad experience. I first struggled with anxiety when I was 19 years old. That's a tough age for anyone, but I was stuck in the closet in small town Ohio. Up until then, I ignored my sexuality or swept it under the rug. Sure, at 14, the hand-me-down jeans I wore to sneak into Cruel Intentions were forced to accommodate a boner anytime Ryan Phillippe showed up on screen, but I was able to convince myself that I was straight. By 19, I was having much more trouble convincing myself. Side note, I know I'm gay because I'm able to spell Phillippe right on one try, while accommodate takes me three tries. The anxiety started when I realized I would either have to come out of the closet or live a life of lies. As I bought myself time, the anxiety started to manifest in physical symptoms. My skin began to break out, my blood would itch, I couldn't catch my breath, and panic attacks started becoming more and more frequent. Eventually, I made an appointment with my primary care doctor when a skin rash developed. The doctor checked me out, asked me a few basic questions, did some blood work, recommended a therapist that I did not end up seeing, and diagnosed me with anxiety before I left the exam room. He prescribed me some pharmaceuticals and sent me on my way. By the time I turned 21, I thought I had the anxiety under control. At 22, I officially came out of the closet to friends and family, and I assumed my struggles were over. I would get the occasional panic attack, which I learned to treat with a low dose of Xanax, but other than that, I felt in control of my emotions. Spoiler alert, I wasn't. January 2015 was when I hit my low point. That's when depression entered the group chat. I've experienced sadness before, but this was something new and it was unfathomable to me. When people talk about depression, they often use it as an adjective to describe a rough breakup period or a time of despair. It's often thrown out into the wild during any old conversation. I'm sorry, we don't have French fries, but I can get you a side salad. Ugh, no fries. I'm so depressed. I'm guilty myself of throwing it around without meaning it, but I'm here to tell you that depression is so much more than a lack of fries. It's debilitating. I think back to that time and I try to put the puzzle pieces together to see the bigger picture of how I got to be the way that I am. I wonder if the depression was always in me, dormant and waiting to say hello, or did a string of events cause some sort of mental break? I'm still working on figuring all this out, so forgive me if I'm leaving certain things vague. All I know for certain is that 2015 is when my life outlook changed forever, and I'll never forget the day it all came to a head on my way to, of all places, a theme park. Leading up to that January, I had some setbacks. I had just lost my grandma, and like I mentioned in another chapter, I held on to a lot of guilt about not seeing her toward the end of her life. I was also struggling to find work and was leaning toward giving up chasing my dreams. Nothing was working for me professionally, and on top of all that, I was also 28, which I read is a historically difficult year to go through. Regardless of this Lemony Snicket series of unfortunate events, I suddenly found myself struggling in a way I wasn't prepared or equipped for. A wave of sadness came over me, and the world seemed a little darker. I felt alone. I wasn't actually alone, mind you. My immediate family lived in Ohio, and I resided in California, but they were always a phone call away, and I had really wonderful friends and a boyfriend who loved me within walking distance. Unfortunately, when I would think about those friends or family that loved me, the depression would morph my memories of those people into graphic novel-style villains. In reality, they were still in my corner, but the depression manifested itself into hallucinations. I couldn't see the kindness in my best friend's eyes. I couldn't believe the support that came from my boyfriend. And my parents looked like monsters to me, even just in memory. It might sound like I'm being metaphorical, but in my case, I would close my eyes, and when I would think of or picture those people closest to me, the depression would visualize them in a different way than I had ever thought of them before. Even the memory of my dear grandma would be completely distorted. I knew they were all there for me, but the disease convinced me otherwise. Depression doesn't want you to see good. It wants you to see the world as a dark and scary place, a place you no longer want to be a part of, and those feelings snowball. Depression is like a tiny dark cell in your body that multiplies faster than you can catch it. Initially, I didn't even want to get out of bed, struggling even to make it to the shower every day. There'd be days in a row where I wouldn't even leave my bed. When I started to notice this negativity sweep my body, I did everything I could to fight it off. I worked out harder, I meditated longer, drank herbal tea. Sounds silly, but if I had even once heard something was good for mental health, I would try it. I was fortunate enough to have the resources to do these things, but they weren't a cure-all. Regardless, it was too little, too late. Hashtag justice for JoJo. The cell had multiplied and I couldn't control it anymore. That was when I realized I had to learn to understand the depression so I could live with it. I noticed around that time that I was also scared of the way my mind was working. I was self-aware enough to know that I wasn't well, but unsure of how to go about helping the cause outside of those commonly known tools like journaling or acupuncture. This fear caused me to want to stay exclusively in what I call my safety zones, or places I was familiar with. My home, my gym, my grocery store. If I traveled outside those safety zones, I was in a constant state of panic that I would somehow crumble to dust. The anxiety was now working in conjunction with the depression, two pieces of shit doing everything they could to ruin my life. When I finally admitted I had a problem, I told my boyfriend who thought it would be a good idea to go to Disneyland. LOL. We live close by, and that, in the moment, seemed like a great place to fight off the feelings inside. Maybe forced happiness isn't the best idea when you're at a low point, but whatever. They have chocolate-covered peanut butter balls you could buy at Pooh's Corner, and I was desperate, so we hopped in a car and made our way to Anaheim to see Mickey Mouse. About 10 minutes into the car ride, I began worrying about being away from those safety zones I told you about. I looked out the window as we were driving, and my eyes were seeing the other vehicles on the road smashing into us and driving off the freeway to a free fall. I looked over at my boyfriend for some comfort, and he looked evil to me. More hallucinations. Remember in Batman Begins when Scarecrow sprays that fear gas and suddenly Batman's face morphs into a crazy clay-like shape? That's what I was seeing, minus a supporting turn from Katie Holmes. Just talking about it still makes me feel uneasy. I had never heard of this type of symptom before. My imagination saw darkness where there was light, and once these thoughts came into my head, I couldn't stop them. I was self-aware enough to know that the cars weren't actually driving themselves off the freeway and that my boyfriend loved me more than anything, but that's what I was seeing. Crashing, one by one. Evil all around me. And knowing what you're seeing is not reality can cause a lot of hysteria. My breath got heavy and fast, and I felt my chest collapsing while I rode passenger. If you've never experienced a panic attack, I hope you never do. It's sort of like when you stand up too quickly and your line of vision gets blurry, but you also can't catch your breath and it feels like you're dying. They are not fun. I tried everything to stop the thoughts and slow down my breathing. I put headphones in my ears and did a 10-minute guided meditation on my iPhone, which calmed me down enough to not feel like I was going to drop dead on the spot. My boyfriend pulled into a gas station and got out of the car. I can't remember if I told him to get out so I could have some space or if he just did it instinctively. All I could do in that moment was focus on my breathing and let one inhale lead me to the next exhale. Deep breath in, hold it. Breathe out. I said to myself, repeat. Deep breath in, hold it, breathe out. I continued this until my heart rate steadied. One time I read that a normal resting heart rate is 60 to 100 beats per minute in adults, so when my heart is racing, I say 59 BPM over and over to myself. I'm not even sure if it's medically accurate, but I visualize my heart beating just a hair slower than average, and when I calm down enough to feel like I hit 59 beats per minute, I can move forward. I don't actually measure my heart rate, although I should. I simply use it as a mantra to calm me down. Something to focus my thoughts and clear the swirling vortex in my head. At around 59 beats per minute, my boyfriend got back into the driver's seat and we made the ridiculous decision to continue our drive to Disney. LOL again. I wanted to go home, but I pushed through because he was doing this for me, and we were closer to the park than we were to home. Did I mention I'm not great at decision making? Once we entered the grounds, I put on the happy face that was expected of me, but beneath the surface, I was in a living hell. There's a picture of me at the park from that day, in front of the big magic castle, smiling in my DuckTales shirt next to my loving boyfriend. Anyone would look at it and think I was having the time of my life, but when I see it, I remember the pain and fear that existed behind my eyes. I remember the hallucinations and the panicked breath of the drive to Disney. It was like that movie Inside Out, only my little cartoon emotions were running around headquarters like chickens with their heads cut off, all the while sirens are blaring. Early on in the visit, my boyfriend excused himself to the restroom, and I cried to myself, wondering how I would make it through the rest of the day he planned. I was both scared and sad. An older woman saw me crying as she waited for her husband to finish up in the restroom, and she asked if I was okay. I put my sunglasses on and told her I was just so happy to be there. I pretended the tears were of joy, and I got away with it because she didn't know the difference between my sad eyes and my happy ones. There are only a handful of friends I've had in my life for years, and they know my looks so well that they would have probably known how I felt before I knew how I felt. That's the beauty of a long-term friend. I somehow tricked everyone into thinking I was having a good time that day, even the camera, but inside I couldn't wait to get home, back to my safety zone. Later on in the day, I excused myself to the restroom, where I locked the door and forced myself to throw up as a way to control emotions that were uncontrollable. The only other time I felt semi-normal was when we rode on Space Mountain, a roller coaster that is super fast and mostly in the dark. I normally hate rides, but something about the speed and lights off made it feel like the outside world was catching up with the way I felt on the inside. As soon as it was over, the tiny relief wore off. Nothing else I did helped, not the corn dog I usually find so satisfying, and not a wave from Goofy himself. The pain that day was so strong on the inside that despite the beauty around me, I simply no longer wanted to live inside my body. I hit my low. People who suffer from migraines often get something called postdrome that happens after the main migraine, kind of like a migraine hangover. I think of that theme park visit as my low point, but the trauma lingered. The immobilizing darkness and hallucinations lasted about a month longer. I wasn't healed after that month, but I was starting to notice some changes in my mood. This all led to me finally seeing a therapist, which was the final piece of the puzzle on my road to recovery. I should have done it sooner. She taught me that those thoughts I was having on the way to Disneyland of the cars on the freeway were the depression trying to normalize suicide. Up until then, I thought my depression wasn't bad because I didn't ever explicitly think of killing myself. I figured the feeling of not wanting to live was somehow unrelated because I hadn't thought about explicitly inflicting pain upon myself. Turns out it all just looked a little different than what I expected. In a weird way, I was trying to cover. I convinced myself that suicide never entered the picture, even though deep down I knew that it did. Sometimes our bodies and minds try to protect us by making us forget our own stories. Plus, depression is able to twist realities in ways you can never anticipate. Ever since that trip to Disneyland, I've spent so much time learning about my brain and doing everything I can to keep that rain cloud away from me. And it hasn't stopped coming, but it comes less frequently. Sometimes I can keep it in check holistically, and other times I need a boost from prescribed medication. Let's take a little detour. The previously mentioned Queen Kelly Clarkson has a song for everything. I mentioned Dark Side, but she also has hits like Stronger and Invincible and Piece by Piece and countless others to help someone when they're down. Her discography is inspirational bop after inspirational bop, alongside a steady stream of angry breakup tracks, grocery store anthems, and gorgeous ballads. One of the lesser-known non-singles is a song called The Sun Will Rise. It's not quite the earworm that something like Since You've Been Gone is, but it's a cheesy mid-tempo bop that I play when I need some inspiration. She sings alongside Cara DioGuardi, and the lyrics move me every time. Even if you don't like the music, you might be able to appreciate the beautiful words. Just like a longtime lover, the dark times don't come as frequently as they once did, but they still come. I've accepted that depression and anxiety will always live inside of me. However, I now have the tools to cohabit. Anyone who comes into my life for the rest of my life will also have to reconcile with the demons that forever reside in my home. When I close my eyes and only see dark clouds, that depression monster, I remind myself that blue skies are beyond those rain clouds and a light will shine again. I've pushed them away before, and I'll just have to keep doing it again and again and again and again and again. I can keep going because I know the sun will rise even when the dark of night feels tangled in time. The sun will always rise. Christmas in June. It's coming from inside the house. When a Stranger Calls, 1979. I live for Christmas. It's my favorite time of year, and I wish I could say that my season is kicked off with the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, which, by the way, is the only place on TV that you can see something like Trishelle from The Real World on a Jennie-O float, singing Up on the Housetop with the California Raisins. But the truth is, I listen to holiday music and watch the Family Stone year-round. Twinkle lights make me happy. Still, I recognize that the cheer is not for everyone. I've talked about many of my awkward moments in this audiobook, but I couldn't possibly include everything. There was the time I accidentally got my envelopes mixed up before I mailed them out, and I sent my newly widowed relative a card that said, "I know you would prefer a big fat ass, but this card will have to do." While my bestie got a birthday card that said, "Sorry for your loss, praying for you." And we'll have to wait until the next book for me to really dive deep about when I applied for an internship at a music company back in the early 2000s and spelled my name with punctuation in place of the vowels to be more like Pink. Needless to say, D@NNY, P$LL$GR! Didn't get the job. Or the time I accidentally ate cupcakes that expired 13 years back on Instagram Live. But I'd be remiss to leave out a pivotal awkward moment regarding my year-round Christmas love. When I moved into the apartment I'm at now, I got fancy and hired a cleaning person to come. I love the Real Housewives, and sometimes I learn good lessons from them, and other times I learn the bad stuff through television osmosis. The bad lessons seeped in, and I was living outside my means, like so many of the women do, by paying for a service that I didn't need, but at least it meant I was getting my place dusted. I reasoned that it became part of my self-care routine. Self-care is a great excuse for bad decisions you want to make. Leaving for an hour once a month and coming back to cleanliness helped me de-stress. The woman I hired was named Martha, and she was an odd gal who would come over and put Pop-Tarts in my freezer so she could snack on one frozen on her way home. She also had a stomach issue that caused her to, how do I put this nicely? Martha would dirty my toilet with her bowels after scrubbing it down. I don't think the frozen treat and bathroom breaks were related, but it happened regularly, and I couldn't get mad because she was so sweet, like a baby angel. On one particular Martha visit in late June, I forgot that she was scheduled, and I was playing on my computer when she arrived. I put the screen to sleep and let her in. Immediately, she noticed some new electronics I had at the house. My boyfriend's a techie, and he's constantly upgrading and buying those home speakers that talk to you and the cleaning robots. The speakers all work in tandem with the computers, although they all seem to have different names and functions, so if you're listening to something in one room, you're listening in all the rooms. Martha right away noticed the machine that vacuums the floor and the one that mops, our own little Rosie from the Jetsons. I'm frankly tired of all this technology, and I assured her they don't clean as good as a human. Martha told me to get the F out of the house so she could clean in peace, so I grabbed my e-reader and went to sit by the communal pool that my unit overlooks for my quiet time. When I got to the space, I noticed a 20-something neighbor on another pool chair, relaxing from the stresses of her life with a frozen cocktail in one hand and a Jenny McCarthy book in the other. The best part about living in California is the weather. Sunshine can totally change your mood, lifting your spirits and boosting your serotonin levels. As the rays hit my face, I released the energy I'd been holding in all week. I could finally take a deep breath, and it felt good to know that I'd returned to a spotless living space. Before I even fired up Kelly Catrone's book on my Kindle, I closed my eyes and bathed in the moment. Bliss. Only a few seconds passed before I heard a familiar sound. It was two men having sex. I may not be a great contestant on Name That Tune, but I can certainly identify the moans of homosexual intercourse. I giggled to myself and glanced over at my neighbor who heard it too. She smiled and looked around to try to find where the sound was coming from as the sex noises continued. "Is that Bryson and Blake?" I said to myself, quietly identifying the thrusts as a smut film that I'm mildly familiar with. Before I could get confirmation, I heard something else I recognized, only this sound was more family-friendly. It was the one and only Miss Piggy, one of the greatest characters of all time, singing her rendition of Santa Baby, originally made famous by Eartha Kitt in the 1950s. "Is that Miss Piggy singing a Christmas song?" my neighbor asked. "I think it might be," I replied, pretending to barely know that it was a Muppet. "And gay porn!" I shouted back to her over the sounds of sleigh bells and two Sean Cody models violently sweating. We both laughed and looked around the complex. Who could possibly be listening to Christmas music and watching gay porn in the middle of a summer workday? Turns out it was me. The sounds were coming from inside my house. "Shit," I said to the neighbor, "that's my apartment." I frantically hopped up from my chair and did my best to slide my toes back into my cheap flip-flops. Perhaps if I had spent less money on someone cleaning, I would have been able to afford more durable summer shoes, but I digress. When I got back into my home, I saw Martha holding one of the multiple speakers that was playing both the carol and porn at full volume. Behind her was my 24-inch desktop computer showcasing the two young gentlemen who were taking turns being inside of each other, coincidentally also at a pool. Martha's eyes were wide as she tried to turn the volume down, but instead she continued to turn it up. The entire apartment building could now hear two of the more commonly played items on my computer. I grabbed the speaker from Martha's hands, but quickly realized I too didn't know how to use it. Without being able to turn it down, I decided I needed to go right to the source. I immediately paused the video player, freezing Bryson and Blake in a compromising position, and doing so just made the Muppet music come in more clearly. I couldn't find the app that was playing the song, but I realized it had to be my Spotify account, specifically my An Iconic Christmas playlist. Everything was happening so fast, I couldn't tell if it was the Alexa machine in charge of the music or the Google one that it was originating from. Did Siri have my Spotify linked? I didn't know how to stop it. I went through each machine, heart racing, just trying to halt the felt diva from getting to another chorus. My vision blurred, and Martha could see I was panicked. It wasn't just her either. The music was loud, but I could sense someone else was near. It was my neighbor, looking through my window, now with her roommate. Together, they cupped their heads against the glass and squinted in to see me nervously shaking in front of Martha and a paused gay porn scene as a pig sang about hurrying down a chimney in June. Martha, bless her soul, took matters into her own hands and unplugged all the speakers from the wall outlets. Time stood still as I gathered my thoughts. There was no proper way to explain porn open on my computer or that I listened to holiday music in the summer. Instead, I just handed Martha her check early, along with an extra tip, telling her not to worry about finishing the gig. "Let's never speak of this again," I said. She grabbed the not-yet-frozen Pop-Tart from the freezer and headed on her way as I closed the curtains on my nosy neighbors. "Happy Gay Pride Month," she said earnestly as she left. The next time Martha came to clean, she brought her own speaker and played music while she scrubbed the kitchen. She typically listened to soft rock when I left, that is, until her December cleaning, which would unfortunately be one of her last. "Merry Christmas, Danny," she cheerfully exclaimed when she arrived. "You too, Martha," I replied. Sadly, she then informed me that she would no longer be able to clean as she was moving out of the state. Right before I left her to her last cleaning, she turned on her own gadget, and I heard a familiar sound. It was Kermit's One True Love singing Santa Baby. "This version is my favorite now," Martha said with a chuckle. It warmed my heart to know she got something more valuable than money from that summer cleaning. My holiday wish every year since is that Martha went on her life journey and not only explored The Muppets, a green and red Christmas album, but also found the timeless work of Bryson. Let's take a little detour. And you don't support other women. You don't acknowledge anybody for anything they do. And as soon as Carol left the party, you talked behind her back. So how have you the audacity to talk to me like you're talking to me? How about you didn't even give Dorinda credit for getting the Nutcracker? Ramona Singer, The Real Housewives of New York City. I've watched a lot of Bravo television. I'm talking hours and hours of footage of wealthy or wealthy pretending women arguing over dinners, in front of psychics, and while in downward dog position with a goat on their back. I'm ready for us to collectively retire goat yoga. I've seen numerous cast combinations fighting at axe-throwing locales and those weird rage rooms where people throw tantrums on yard sale junk. One thing I know for sure when it comes to the Real Housewives franchise, even those silly moments can teach us valuable info. From Sonia Morgan, I learned to always be the straw that stirs the drink. Dr. Wendy taught me to always address a doctor correctly, sweetie. And Taylor Armstrong showed me what to do when enough is enough. Sometimes important questions are raised, like when Kathy Hilton finally brought up something that should be on all our minds. Who is Hunky Dory? Because of this TV franchise, I know that when it comes to romantic entanglements, it's important to find a man who emotionally fulfills you, know that, and also fills your love tank. Family should be thick as thieves and never steal your goddamn house. In career, it's imperative to align yourself with companies that aren't antiquated, to support other women, and to not announce your new business venture until it's ready to be released. And no, September, spring, summer is not a specific enough date. There are ideas big and small hidden in every episode, in particular when it comes to toxic friendships and protecting your emotional space. On the season one finale of The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, Meredith Marks is talking to Jen Shah, who had been talking about Meredith's marriage behind her back throughout the season. When Jen pulls her aside to apologize for her actions, Meredith responds with, "I need to protect my positive space, and I don't have room for the negativity right now." She disengaged. Most of us in Meredith's position would instinctively accept Jen's apology and then continue the cycle, but Meredith took the road less traveled. That is deep. We are fragile beings, and allowing too much negative energy will break us if we allow it in. The Real Housewives are, of course, meant to be enjoyed with a glass of wine and some friends, but don't miss the lessons. While these women can be dramatic and unpredictable, they are also a reflection of our own lives. They are the mirror. Every so often, I look around at my people and take stock of the relationships around me to decide if they are good for me. The people on screen might not be able to completely distance themselves from the toxicity around them without actually leaving the show and the paycheck behind, but the rest of us can. A star is in the theater? Hey, what? I just wanted to take another look at you. A Star is Born, 2018. Every year on my birthday, a sense of melancholy washes over me that is not easily rid of. I spend the days and week before wondering if I'm metaphorically behind in life. Did I accomplish all the things I wanted to by the age I'm at? No. Is my life set up the way I hoped it would be by this age? Never. Sometimes I feel like Super Mario in one of the water levels, frantically paddling through, dodging the devilfish and occasionally gasping for air. I'm sure everyone feels this way, but looking around in your 30s and seeing old friends and family on social media with their fancy houses and babies, it's hard not to feel less than. Less than because I don't own a house, less than because I have no kids, and less than because I don't have abs. I feel judged by my peers, and all the while I'm scrolling Instagram and judging the celebrities on my feed with a leftover roadside slider from the Cheesecake Factory in my free hand. It's a vicious circle of judgment. When the big birthday finally arrives every year, I'm already in such a low state that very little could bring me out of my funk, and this makes it impossible for the people around me to properly celebrate me each October. Not enough attention, and I absolutely sink into a deep despair that leaves me feeling broken. But too much attention, and I emotionally snap, tears suddenly flowing like dough bursting out of one of those barely cracked Pillsbury cans. My loved ones can't win. Pay attention to me, but don't pay any attention to me at all. Look at me, then look away. It's not just an adult thing either, because celebrating the passing of time never sat right with me, even in my youth. I spend most birthdays doing the same thing, dinner and a movie. Simple and easy for all involved. Food is the spot of my choice, either just with my boyfriend or a small group of my inner circle. I let them pay for me, but I'm adamant that we don't do the happy birthday song and dance with the servers at the restaurant. I hate that. Just bring out the slice of cake and spare me the workers the voice audition, because I'm certainly not turning around my chair if I hear an off-key melody from someone wearing flair. It's not because I want to be rude to the staff. As a former server myself, I know they don't want to sing, and I simply cannot bear that kind of attention. A flick usually follows the meal. There's always at least one decent or fun bad movie released during that first week of October or late September. Typically, it's one of those films that's 5 stars and also just 1 star. You know, fun bad. It all adds up to the perfect amount of birthday activity. Anything less than, and friends and coworkers will make me feel bad the next day when they ask me what I did for my birthday. If I say I did nothing, they'll look down on me, sinking the emotional ship even further. Anything more outlandish, and those same people will not only make me feel bad for not including them, but they will also judge me for doing too much. Suddenly, you're one of those attention-seeking crazies in their eyes. Let's take a little detour. Another birthday tradition is watching my favorite episode of Sex and the City. It's season 4, episode 1, titled The Agony and the Ecstasy. The episode centers around Carrie's 35th birthday, but it has a little bit of everything. There's Samantha's sexual obsession with her priest, Friar Fuck, Charlotte's frustration with Trey's sex drive, and a birthday party from hell. It all culminates in the women meeting for some late-night food, Carrie in tears, monologuing to the girls about being 35 and alone, only to end with Charlotte suggesting they all be each other's soulmates instead of looking at men to fill the position. It's a beautiful moment, and to me, the crux of the entire series in that one scene at the end. Carrie leaves the restaurant, and Big is waiting outside her apartment with balloons. It's sad, but hopeful. Not sure how this got so bleak, but another thing I hate is opening gifts in front of people. The pressure to perform as the person who is gifted an item is far greater than the pressure to perform in the bedroom or work, or anywhere else, really. There's nothing worse than having all eyes on you, waiting to see how much you like a gift. You're forced to show the right mix of excitement, gratitude, and emotion, and it never feels like enough. When I open gifts, I barely have time to notice the actual item because I'm so worried about reacting appropriately and reaching the expectations that the other person has set for me. And those cards that have graves on them and tell people they're over the hill with a picture of the Grim Reaper? Give me one of those if you want our relationship to end. I'd rather get a hug from Satan himself than a piece of paper from a friend telling me that I'm close to death. All of this is to say that I'm an impossible nightmare on my birthday. One October a few years ago, the Lady Gaga A Star Is Born remake was released, so of course it became my birthday movie. Not quite the good-bad style film I usually see, but I was excited because it's Queen Gaga and the reviews were great. I told my boyfriend I wanted to see it on a Saturday afternoon at my favorite movie theater in Los Angeles. This theater has plush reclining chairs, cozy and clean blankets, and servers that bring you food and drinks throughout the flick. Tickets are a little pricey, but it's justifiable for a special occasion. "Do you want to invite any friends?" my boyfriend asked when he was pre-ordering the tickets the week prior. "I don't know. Surprise me," I said with my Libra-ness on full display, uninterested in making a concrete decision. When it was finally time, we got in the car and headed to the theater. A lot of my close friends were suspiciously quiet leading up to the big day, so I thought maybe they were planning a surprise or that my boyfriend planned something, but I couldn't be sure. Normally, we would get to the theater early to have a drink and order some food before the preview started, but we ran into some traffic and arrived after the lights had already gone down. We sat in our seats, cozied up with the provided blanket, and basked in the glory of a Jennifer Lopez movie trailer. I always enter a trance when I'm in a darkened movie theater, my absolute favorite place on earth. The feature presentation started, and I got lost in Lady Gaga's performance and Bradley Cooper's mumble mouth. He spent the entire film talking like he had a yapper full of marbles or a spoonful of peanut butter, so it felt like I had to pay extra attention to understand what was going on. I was on the edge of my seat. About midway through, I noticed a man in front of me stand up and head out to what I assumed was the bathroom. The light from the screen caught the corner of his face for a split second, and as he turned around, I realized he was familiar. It was Jonathan Groff, I think. For the unfamiliar, Jonathan Groff is an actor who starred in HBO's Looking and Glee and played Kristoff in the Frozen movies. He's also Lea Michele's best friend. Lea Michele, of course, starred in Glee, and at the time of this movie-going experience, there were no widely available allegations against her. I only knew her as the lead of a show I liked and one of the 87 celebrities in Gary Marshall's New Year's Eve, so my excitement was through the roof. When I realized it might be Jonathan Groff, I looked down at the person seated next to him. It was the Lea Michele, I think. Now, as a certified geek who watched every episode of that series from 2009 to 2015, I was excited. Again, remember that was a different time and Glee was popular. Stop judging me. Hindsight is 20/20. A lot of us liked it. Now, my boyfriend knew how much I liked the show, and that sent my inner dialogue into overdrive. Did my boyfriend plan for Lea Michele and Jay Groff to be here? Is Lea going to sing happy birthday to me after the movie? Who else is in the audience? I hope Matthew Morrison doesn't pop out, I thought. I started to look to see who else was around me. The seats are so far apart in those rooms with the reclining chairs that it was hard to tell, but I thought I maybe saw my friend Nick, and perhaps across the way was my buddy Amy. And in the back, it's possible I noticed one of my besties, Jenna. I looked over at my man, and he was already fast asleep, snoring while Gaga was singing Shallow. How could he fall asleep during such an iconic movie performance? I figured the only logical reason was that he was taking a nap because he knew as soon as the credits rolled that he would have to get the party started and present a Lea Michele-Jonathan Groff duet in front of a room full of my friends. I mean, he planned to have them sing to me on my birthday, right? The rest of the film was a blur. Aside from looking around the theater and trying to figure out who was there, I was mesmerized by maybe Lea Michele watching Lady Gaga's feature film debut. I thought about how it must have killed Lea that it wasn't her on that screen. Surely the role was something she wanted, because what singing young actress wouldn't? Plus, she's a notable Barbra Streisand fan, and A Star is Born is one of Barbra's most iconic films. On top of all of that, there's the nose subplot. On Glee, they wrote in that Lea's character was considering a nose job. It was the episode they mashed up I Feel Pretty with Unpretty by TLC, which even saying that sentence proves that the show was truly crazed, but I digress. I tried my best to get a clear view of maybe Lea's face watching Lady Gaga's character Allie talk about her sniffer, and it was thrilling. When I wasn't doing that, I was thinking about what a great boyfriend I had. He organized this all for me, and surely I'd have to repay him on his next birthday. But until then, how could I show my proper gratitude? Like I said, I hate opening gifts and feeling like I have to perform my thankfulness, but this was extra special, and I was willing to do my own best reacting. I had to step it up and really lay it on thick when the lights came up in the darkened room. In my seat, I practiced my surprise face, warming it up the way a basketball player stretches before a big game. I loosened my jaw and quietly raised my brows, rehearsing what I would do when Lea and Jonathan took to the mic. At the end of A Star is Born, Gaga's Allie sings I'll Never Love Again, a beautiful ballad dedicated to the love of her life, who harrowingly peed himself earlier in the film. In my opinion, it's the best song in it. I think I like it because it feels like a classically 90s movie ballad. Shallow is amazing too, don't get me wrong, but that final song breaks me every time I hear it. So at the end of the movie, Lady Gaga is singing this heart-wrenching ballad, and you can hear the sniffles from everyone in the audience. Well, almost everyone. In those fancy theaters, the servers come around and bring you your check as the movies are wrapping up. They're shining tiny flashlights on receipts so people pay up before leaving. It's very distracting, especially when a movie is ending as emotionally as A Star is Born. The servers were going around to each guest and collecting credit cards from people sobbing from this incredibly sad movie moment, and you can hear the employees being as respectful as possible every time they interrupt someone to get them to pay, but it's frustrating nonetheless. When the server arrived at our area, we weren't exactly crying. My boyfriend was still snoring, and I was smiling, practicing my surprised faces, and looking like Taylor Swift winning an award circa 2008. Eventually, the credits began to roll, and the other patrons, including maybe Jonathan and maybe Lea, got up to head toward the exit. I assumed they had to go warm up their vocals for my personalized happy birthday performance. I would have immediately woken up my boyfriend, but I started to think maybe this was all part of his plan. He was pretending to sleep so the theater could clear out and Lea could enter with my besties and surprise me. How cute of him. The credits came to an end, and pretty soon we were the only ones left in the room outside of a wheelchair user who was waiting for everyone else to clear. There was a split second I thought it might be the Artie character from Glee, but alas, it was not. My excitement started dwindling when our server came and asked me if there was a problem. No, sorry, I was just letting him sleep a little longer, I said, winking when I delivered the word sleep. Okay, well, if you wouldn't mind, we need a clean-up for the next showing, the employee replied. My brain couldn't compute that my fantasy was not going to be a reality. I nudged my boyfriend and he woke up confused as to why we were sitting in an empty theater with the lights on. How long have I been asleep? He asked. It finally dawned on me that he wasn't pretending. Slowly but surely, I was starting to get it. We got up and I silently processed the info that Lea and Jonathan wouldn't be serenading me as I ushered in a new year of my life. Before I could accept my fate, my boyfriend told me to wait a minute and that he would be right back. I'm so stupid. Of course we had to clear the theater, but this surprise is still happening. We just need to go to a different location at the theater, someplace where balloons and banners are already set up. And when I enter, everyone will yell, "Surprise!" And then Leah and Jonathan will be singing to me, I thought to myself as he ran off toward the restroom. I began to practice my surprise face again. This time more emotionally spent, so my smile looked like lipstick-smeared Dorinda Medley in Cartagena on The Real Housewives of New York. "What the hell are you doing with your face?" my boyfriend said when he arrived back from the bathroom. "Oh, nothing, you," I replied playfully. "I need to validate. Do you have the parking ticket?" he asked. I handed it to him, and he slid it into the machine in the lobby to pay. Instead of leading me into another room in the theater, he began to head outside the building into the parking garage. When we got in the car, my excitement once again started to diminish. I thought maybe we were driving to a restaurant or somewhere else for the surprise, but when we pulled down our street, I knew this was it. I didn't say much to him on that drive, and I even started to resent him. How could he do this to me? How could he not plan to have all my friends see A Star Is Born with us and then organize a recording artist and an animated film star to sing for me on my birthday? Unfortunately, I knew I couldn't even hold it against him. It was me who created this fantasy world in my head. I could only be mad at myself, so I would have to let it go, much like Jonathan's Frozen co-star once sang in what was surely another performance that Leah wished she had booked. That's the problem with birthdays. There's too much pressure to do something big and too much disappointment if you do something small. Like Goldilocks, I'm forever trying to fill the day with something just right. And like Gaga sang in Shallow, I too am tired of trying to fill that void. Now that I think about it, perhaps Shallow really is the better song.